You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jens Hoffman. He's in New York at the moment. Jens, thanks for being with me today.
It's very good to be there.
So, Jens, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now at the Jewish Museum. I want to talk about a number of other things, but what is your role at the Jewish Museum, and what are you currently involved in there?
I started at the Jewish Museum to oversee the exhibitions and collections about 3 years ago in a newly created role of deputy director for exhibitions and public. So for the last couple of years, I've been looking over acquisitions for the museum, have worked on the schedule of exhibitions for the museum, and designed sort of the public programs, talks, panel discussions, film screenings, also directing the film festival that the Jewish Museum is doing.
And so what is it, is there a show you're working on now at the moment that's in planning as part of your role?
Last week we opened an exciting new show about a very influential Brazilian landscape architect. His name is Roberto Bula Marx. He was working mostly in the 20th century. He was born in 1909 and died in 1904, and was incredibly prolific. But the interesting thing is that he wasn't only like a garden designer or a landscape architect. He did a lot of other things. He was a very accomplished painter. He was a designer for jewelry, for theater design, for costumes and textiles, a real Renaissance man in the 20th century. So we opened that on Tuesday, and it's been an incredible success. I'm extremely happy how everything turned out.
And your role in that was curating that, highlighting his work.
Yeah, I was the curator of that show.
And you curated in many other places. How do you, and you've been now at the new museum, the Jewish Museum, for almost 4 years. How does that differ in terms of a number of other institutions you've worked in?
Well, it's the Jewish Museum is definitely the largest institution that I've worked in so far. But I'm fortunate to be sort of like on the top of the hierarchy, which means a lot of things are rather, accessible and not so difficult for me. But, I remember maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when I began my museum career and I would be working in a museum like this, it was much more difficult. An enormous amount of bureaucracy that you have to, work your way through. But now it's good. I'm lucky.
But is that also something because your whole early career in curating was in Europe? Is there a very distinct approach in terms of institutions in Europe as opposed to America?
Well, one of the things that really makes a big difference is that in the U.S. you have to do much more fundraising for the exhibitions. There's no state funding or no government funding in the United States. So all of the money that you need to make your exhibitions has to be raised either from foundations, corporations, or individuals. And in Europe, you still have a lot of money coming from the government, city government, state government, or from the federal government. That's a real big, it's a huge difference.
And how does that affect you as a curator? As a deputy director, I imagine the part of your role is to help in raising that money. But how does that affect the ability of you doing your job in Europe as opposed to America, that with that kind of funding difference?
Well, I think that the responsibilities that you have as someone working in a museum in the U.S. are much bigger. You're much more accountable for how many people are coming and what do they get out of the exhibition. People are much more, they just want to know what is actually really happening with the money that you do. Whereas in Europe, I remember working in museums in Europe and there was very little oversight in terms of what are your audience figures, how many reviews, or what kind of response you get in the press, and all of this was much less accentuated. Here, you really have to demonstrate that you're successful.
For a curator or Or worse.
Sorry?
I mean, on one hand, is that better for a curator or worse? On one hand, I'm an American, and I think, you know, it's wonderful that, you know, in Europe there is so much state funding, and although it's all, you know, ending more and more now, do you think that system is better for a curator flourishing him? And I guess you must, because you're here in America. But I'm just wondering if that really is probably the best paradigm, or should there be more state funding, is I guess what I'm asking.
No, that's a good question. I mean, on the one hand, I think, yes, it would be much more easier for the cultural institutions if there was more funding coming from the cities, the states, counties, or the federal government. But you get used to it when you work here, and it's sort of just like the way this works. And in some way, there is an effect of having more responsibility. That's kind of interesting, because I think much more about the audience. I think much more like about how is this actually accessible for an audience that isn't like exposed to art on an everyday level, and trying to sort of like really mediate what sometimes really difficult conceptual art pieces are, you know. And in Europe, people don't, I mean, the other thing that I noticed, especially like when I was working in England and in Germany, was that there were way more museums and art centers throughout the entire country. So I always felt like in Europe there was a higher literacy grade when it comes to art than in the United States, where people are often still very alienated.
That's true. Higher literacy rate. That's very interesting. Kind of a visual literacy. I guess we're really talking about. So maybe we should, you know, I'd like to talk about the People's Biennial a little bit and how that was started, but maybe since we're just talking about this kind of work, I'd love to talk a little bit about the show you did with Tino Segal years ago, which is how I first knew of your name, and I may be misinterpreting this, but it was my feeling that solo show that you did of Tino Segal was very pivotal in putting him on the international scene to some degree. Is that the case, do you think?
Well, I've worked with Tino on a number of occasions, and his very first show was in at the Kunstwerk in Berlin that I organized, and we did a couple of other shows together. And I'm not sure which show you're referring to. I guess maybe the show at the ICA?
Yeah. It was more of a retrospective, that's right.
Well, the ICA show was interesting because I decided that I would do three solo shows over the period of 3 years with Tino. And the reason for that was that I felt like Tino's work wasn't necessarily very easy. It wasn't like immediately accessible for audiences. And I just thought, if you do three solo shows over the period of 3 years, people sort of like get used to it. They start understanding it. They get sort of familiarized with it. And little by little, you sort of like build up. So each show got a little more complicated. Each show, people felt like more comfortable with it. And at this, in the third year, the piece was incredible. It was called This Progress, and you were guided around the building, and people were asking you questions about, you know, what you think progress is. So,
well, that's what he did at the Guggenheim. That was the Guggenheim solo show.
That was the Guggenheim show, but the first version of that was shown at the ICA in London.
So is he an example then? I mean, because this is what I imagined in your relationship with him and his career. As a curator, you were enormously instrumental in bringing his work to the public and helping the public understand his work.
Yeah, I mean, I see my role too, as someone who discovers artists and you know, brings them into to public attention, brings them into the museum and shows them. Yeah, definitely.
And so maybe that you know, leads us into the People's Biennial, because that's partly why that was created, right? As far as the deputy director of the Jewish Museum, you're not in quite the same role of bringing young artists like Tino Segal was to the public. Is that correct?
Yeah, not necessarily on that sort of level. And the People's Biennial was actually a project that I started many years before I moved to the Jewish Museum. I was still in San Francisco working as a director of the Waters Institute, and I met an artist called Harold Fletcher, who studied at the California College of the Arts, which was the college that the Waters Institute was connected to. And he and I started about the use of amateur art in the artwork of professional artists, and we just sort of wondered what would it look like if we would do an entire show just made of artists that were not trained in an MFA program, but were just like doing art because they liked it, not because they wanted to have a career, not because they wanted to make money. So that's how sort of the People's Biennial began. But also as a sort of antidote to these really established biennials, like the Whitney Biennial or something like the Carnegie International, like looking at artists who were aesthetically and intellectually or conceptually outside the mainstream and maybe had more sort of a regional touch or had like connections to outsider art or folk art, those sort of things.
And that is a wonderful approach. So then how did you both, you and Harold, begin curating for that show? That would seem a particular challenge to curate.
I had connections with an organization here in New York called Independence Curators International. And what they've done for many decades is organizing touring exhibitions. They like organize the shows, and then they basically rent them out to a number of institutions throughout the United States. So they had a really great network of museums throughout the U.S. that I wanted to tap into. And I proposed the People's Biennial to ICI and said, like, you know, we want to take this show to many different places. What can we do? And we realized that there was a big interest. People really liked the idea. And we found 5 different museums throughout the United States that wanted to work with us on this project. So we traveled to each of those cities, looked at artists from those cities, and then we selected artists that were there and created this big show. And then the show toured to these different cities, one after the other. So it was interesting because there was always a local component in each show. And
as the show traveled from city to city, in each city, local artists joined the show and continued to travel with it, or only for that show?
So we went to the 5 cities the museums were in, and we selected like 10 artists from each city. So we had like about 50 artists, and then the show would be presented in each of those cities. So each time we had part of the show being local artists, which was great because they came, they supported, they brought their friends, they wanted to see their own work, but they also saw the work of the people from these other cities. So it was a really nice way of like connecting the local with a sort of, or the regional with a sort of more national platform.
Hmm. And what will happen next? Is the 2017 version of that, is that just another tour? Is that a whole new selection of artists? How will the next iteration of that come together?
Well, we did one at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit in 2015, and we invited professional artists to each, like one artist that was not professional. And with professional, I mean not an artist that necessarily has a big gallery career and makes a lot of money and shows in museums, but artists that are sort of like a little hidden, maybe a little unrecognized, and do a collaboration with them. So we presented those. That was like about 15 artists, and we presented that at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit. And the next one, next year, is going to be at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Indianapolis. And I always like to work with the People's Biennial in these contexts that are outside New York, L.A., or Chicago, smaller cities, more local, more regional places, and to look at sort of like the art that's going on there and pair that and put that in dialogue with what's happening in the centers.
And so is that what will be happening in Indianapolis? Will there be artists paired, choosing other artists and creating these kind of pairings or collaborations?
What I noticed in Indianapolis after a couple of visits was that there were a lot of groups that were making art. We went to like a hospital. We went to a fire station. We went to like all these different places, and they were like all having these art classes or art groups. And my idea was that I wanted to connect these art groups with a professional artist from somewhere or around the world. And the art group would then, in collaboration with the artist, create a new artwork that we then present for the biennial.
And so the art group could be, for example, like a senior citizen center.
Absolutely. We have a senior
citizen center.
Funded
by the church or something like that.
We have a hospital group. We have the Firemen's Association there in Indianapolis. Like all these different sort of associations and groups that exist in cities that make art and we connected them with international artists to make new works in collaboration.
And so that's very exciting, you know, and on one level it presents something very new to the public, but also for these groups that you're reaching, it's also bringing them into a dialogue that they may not have ever been in before, unlike the other artists in the show.
Yeah, it's true. They actually get to understand and see how a professional artist works and, you know, get to ask this person lots of questions in case, you know, they were ever interested in, like, entering that field and having a career like that. But also, you know, just to sort of learn from them and get inspired and dialogue with them. And I think it's also the other way around. Just for, like, for the artists, it's super interesting to understand the histories of those places and the local particularities, you know, especially artists that are really used to operating globally.
Well, and that's true, and I think also probably the way other people handle materials. I know, you know, as an artist myself, I remember at one point wanting to work with children because the way children apply and use color is very different than the way adults do. And as an artist, it's amazing to watch that and be influenced by that. So I would imagine all these centers and groups could also influence the artists in the same way, in that they have their own, I wouldn't maybe say they all have their own language, but a kind of very different approach to materials, of course, than you'd get from academic artists.
Yeah, no, I think so. It's really a sort of like a win-win situation where both sides feed off each other.
And when will that biennial open in Indianapolis?
In August of 2017. And there's the Museum of Contemporary Art there. But there will be sites throughout the city. It's not only going to be in the museum itself.
So what kind of sites throughout the city? How will that work?
The museum there has a lot of initiatives that they're doing in something that's called East Side, the Near East Side. There was sort of like a moment of like real extreme depopulation in that neighborhood, and a lot of houses were foreclosed and are empty and are currently owned by the city. And in a deal with the city, the museum was able to acquire some of those houses temporarily and start our project there. So our idea is that we would have one or two pairings in one of those houses, maybe have like 20 houses in total, and then have a center, sort of like an information visitor center in the museum itself.
That's very interesting. It sounds like a wonderful opportunity with all that real estate then to be using.
Yeah. Especially because those areas are quite depressed and there's, you know, sort of, I guess, 60% unoccupancy in those areas there. A lot of empty houses.
So that's wonderful, and I hope a lot of the listeners are able to come to that. One other thing I wanted to ask you, since we're also talking about how, you know, these artists are also who are in the centers, who are outside the mainstream, get influenced by other artists who are professional artists. When to ask again about Tino Segal, since that relationship was very close and you were watching his career, you know, bloom in a sense, were you also instrumental in helping how his works reach the market? Because part of what, you know, has always fascinated me about Tino's work is not just, you know, that I love the experiences and being there and the conversations that happen, but also, you know, as most artists and people, I think, feel, the way it enters the market's quite extraordinary, without a contract, without documentation, and it's a very curious method of being sold. So what I'm asking is, what was your role in creating that? Because that's so unique.
Well, I guess like what we did was sort of like prepare his work to be appreciated or somehow sort of entering the market. You know, I never really, I didn't approach any galleries to represent him. Galleries were showing up after a while and they wanted to represent him. And I think, you know, during that period, Tino and I discussed a lot how that could happen. But I wasn't really particularly instrumental. I was just sort of like probably advisor in terms of how this could happen, you know.
but it was a very new idea. It was a new paradigm, really. I mean, all the artists before then, Marina Abramović, others, no one had ever sold their performances or had an idea like that. They were arguably doing something a little different, but that paradigm could have been used had they presented it at the time, perhaps, couldn't they?
Oh, yeah, they could have, but they didn't think of it. I mean, it was just like Tino's principle and whatever he does in terms of his work or the way that he interacts within the art world is to not create any material residue. So it wasn't really about selling any objects that were used in the performances or, not even a contract, as you say, or not even like a receipt for a wire transfer exists. It's like all absolutely immaterial. And it's sort of coming from an ecological point of view. He just doesn't want to sort of pollute the environment with more objects, with more garbage, with more stuff. It's thinking about economy in a different way, in a sort of immaterial way. It's not like the transformation of material from one type of good into another, but just really thinking about how can an economy function that is completely immaterial.
And that's partly informed by his own background in economics, isn't it? He had a degree in economics. Perhaps that's also influences it a little
absolutely,
bit.
Absolutely, yeah. Of course.
Because,
he
of
got
course,
a very...
other art... Yeah, I'm sorry, go on.
No, he, of course, studied economy, and he studied dance. And when you put the one thing together with the other, someone who was very, very knowledgeable about the history of economics and at the same time also very knowledgeable about the history and nature of dance and choreography, it makes total sense where he landed, because dance, of course, just like every other performance art, is very transitory. It just exists in a particular moment. As soon as it is done, it also disappears again. And I think that's really what fascinated him about these elements, dance, movement, voices, and so on.
It is fascinating, and it does, of course, fit in with everything he's doing. Do you think that paradigm? I mean, since that's one notion of how now performance artists could potentially enter the marketplace. Do you see that being used by other people at all, or no? Because I personally don't. But is it? I mean, I suppose there are some conceptual works that you could say are continue to be sold that way. But in performance, is there anything like that happening other than with Tino?
No, I haven't seen that yet. And I think the problem is just that he made such a mark with doing that, that if any other artist would sort of pick up on that idea, it would just simply look as if it's just sort of, a ripoff of what Tino was doing. So it's difficult, even though I think that he would have liked it for other people to be picked up and continued his idea there, The truth is, of course, he sort of like embodies a very particular idea of art that comes after the object, that comes after all of our sort of ideas that we have about art in the 20th century. So he's like very much on the forefront with a lot of his ideas. It's not object-based, and it doesn't really work within the logic of the art world as it is today in 2016.
Well, maybe that's also partly what other performance artists aren't even understanding. I remember years ago there was a roundtable discussion with Tino and other people at MoMA, and Marina Abramović was there. And I just remember at one point in the conversation when someone was saying, well, of course, Tino is selling works regularly, and Marina leaned forward and she said, yes, how do you do that, right? And, of course, it wasn't answered. But you could see this kind of – she felt that, could she do that? And even yesterday I interviewed – Ule, not that, I don't know why I'm mentioning them together, but obviously because they were, but he was also, off the record talking to another curator about Tina Segal, someone that was, I think, inspirational.
But Tina's work doesn't really have anything to do with this sort of traditional notion of performance art. That's like a really important distinction.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's almost a misunderstanding when Marina or Ule or others are applying it to performance art, because really what he's doing, though they may think it's similar, has nothing to do with the kind of work that Marina is doing or others.
Totally. Yeah, nothing to do with it.
Let me just ask this one last question. Is there a book you're reading now or anything that you'd want to share with us?
Yeah, I'm reading a book about translation and the difficulties about translation. It's by Emily Apter, and it sort of talks about the ethics of translation and how you translate literature from one language into the other, and what's kind of lost, and what are sort of like the ethical implications of that. So I would, you know, it sort of talks about literature and translation and literature, but it sort of like really covers a lot of ground also when you think about something like Tino's work, where you have, you know, someone buying the piece and they get the instructions and then they have to interpret it. And each time it's interpreted, it's sort of different. So there's a certain ethics involved, I guess, as well.
Thanks for sharing that. Jens, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Totally great. Thank you very, very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.